Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a massive Russian military buildup in Crimea on its border with Ukraine and assess the growing possibility that Russia is preparing to go to war, with President Putin vowing, quote, further security measures in response to an alleged Ukrainian incursion in which an FSB intelligence officer and a Russian soldier were supposedly killed in what Putin angrily denounced as a stupid and criminal act. A former Swedish diplomat who served in Moscow, Anders Usland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, joins us to discuss Putin's likely intention to attack Ukraine on two fronts to open up a land corridor to Crimea, following the failure by a corrupt crony of Putin's to build a bridge from Russia to Crimea after billions were embezzled. We will also look into how a nice little war will help Putin at home ahead of the September elections and also help Donald Trump, who has staked a claim that Obama is too weak to handle Putin, assuming Obama does not make a stand soon to deter Putin from what appears to be preparation to resume his war with Ukraine. Then we'll speak with Garrett Epps, a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, about his latest article at The Atlantic, Is Trump Guilty of Inciting Violence Against Clinton? We will analyze what Trump said yesterday, which many are interpreting as an invitation to Second Amendment people, as Trump calls them, to stop Hillary Clinton, once she becomes president, from appointing Supreme Court justices by assassinating her. Then finally, with four U.S. presidents having been assassinated, with two more having been shot and attempts on others, we will look into the way gun rights fanatics and right-wing militia members interpret what they call Second Amendment measures. Tom Diaz, a former senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and the author of The Last Gun, How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What It Will Take to Stop It, joins us to discuss what Second Amendment people who wear T-shirts with snipers on rooftops mean by rooftop voting. And joining us now is Anders Usland, who is a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva and Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the government of Russia, Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. And his latest is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Usland.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And there are rumors of war now on the border between Crimea and Ukraine. The Russians have accused Ukraine of two incursions into what used to be, of course, a part of Ukraine, Crimea. And the FSB, the Russian intelligence agency, have said that one of their employees is being killed along with a Russian soldier. And Vladimir Putin vowed further security measures in response to what he calls Ukraine's stupid and criminal acts. So there's a tremendous amount of troop movements. The ferries across from the Russian Federation to Crimea apparently being packed with military vehicles. Roads in the north are being closed, the north of Crimea near the Ukraine border. So what's your sense of what's happening here? Is this a war game or a possibility of, you know, a real war breaking out?
I think it's more likely that it's a real war breaking out than just a war game, but both are possible. The idea of a war game would be to get everybody up on their toes, to increase repression on Crimea, and to improve Putin's standing among the electorate and mobilize the electorate before the Duma elections on the 18th of September. But as you mentioned, we have seen a tremendous a lot of things happening today in the last week. So today there were two big things. One was this FSB statement about what had happened on 6, 7 and 8th of August. And these are completely minor things. That the Ukrainian government is reporting that Russian intelligence is doing virtually every week in Ukraine. And then President Putin comes out with this very strong statement saying that Ukraine has opted for terror. So my reading of it is that Putin has decided now I'm going to war.
And would his motives be, you mentioned the Duma elections, the economy is tanking. Is this one of the more sort of mendacious and unfortunately tried and true methods of rule, that you distract the people with foreign adventures, distract them from their domestic problems with foreign adventures?
Indeed, I think this is the central element that Putin has very much taken to heart. So I think that this is a rational play on popular feelings. I don't think that we should think that Putin is silly. He's simply a good manipulator.
And of course, even if they don't get to a shooting war, this is a strain on Ukraine because it has such a frail economy. And anything that Putin does to provoke problems, both in the east of Ukraine and now in the south on the border with Crimea, all of that puts extra strain on a country that's sort of pretty much on the brink, isn't it?
Indeed, and if you look upon what happened today, within 2 hours, all the relevant Ukrainian authorities had made harsh statements after this FSB statement that this was unacceptable, it was unjustified, and it has no substance, this was Russian aggression. This is the Minister of Defense, the General Staff, the Security Services, the National Security Council in Ukraine, and so also President Poroshenko. Well, I must admit that I have not heard one word from any foreign Western government. Are they asleep? Are they all on holiday? Don't they have anybody who keeps up the motions of government?
Well, are you saying, though, Anders Aslan, that Russian provocations on the Crimean border are stoking nationalism in Ukraine?
I wouldn't say that that is much of a problem. I think it would be rather weakening, because Ukrainians say we have been here for so long, haven't we accomplished more? So I think that this could be a trouble for President Poroshenko now. And what is the immediate concern? That is that Russia would opt for a so-called land bridge from Donbass to Crimea, to take the whole southern coast through Mariupol to Crimea, because they have failed to build a bridge over the Kerch Strait, which is a few miles broad,
right,
which they had intended to build. But now the crony of Putin, Arkady Rotenberg, who's supposed to build the bridge, says, I can't build it. I don't know how to do it. I stop.
He's taken some money, I imagine. But, I mean, what is the limitations of a contractor not being able to build a bridge? It's not technical, is it?
He has taken several billion dollars for it already.
Right.
And then he just said, I stop, I can't build it. And since this is one of Putin's closest friends, he seems to simply accept it. So there's also the idea that Crimea is a complete failure, partly because of very strict Western sanctions, partly because infrastructure is difficult. The Ukrainian has cut down supplies of water, and they have cut off electricity to Crimea, and the Russians can't manage it on their own.
So would this then, just to speak in military terms, in terms speculating what this enormous amount of military buildup that is occurring on the border between Crimea and Ukraine in the north of Crimea, there's no question about it. Apparently the Russians have been shooting down OSCE drones that have been trying to look into what's happening. There's something happening there. So you're talking about the land corridor from the Donbas, where the Russians already have their surrogates, all the way through along that coast into Ukraine to get around the fact that they were not able to build a bridge across the straits because of corruption from Putin's closest crony, who pocketed billions instead of building the damn thing. Would that be, therefore, would an attack into across the border from Crimea into Ukraine be a way to distract the Ukrainian army, and then he'd attack on the other side through the Donbas?
Yeah, probably we would see both at the same time. There have been reports of hundreds of tanks and heavy artillery coming in both to Donbas and to Crimea. So the to Crimea, tanks have been transported by ships from Novorossiysk, the big port in southern Russia. So there has been a big build-up. Russia has now Caucasus 2016 military exercise in the southern in its southern military district. And you remember that they had a Caucasus 2008 military exercise in the southern district when they happened to go to war with Georgia in August 2008. So the immediate parallel is it's the war with Georgia in 2008, which also happened during the Olympics, then in Beijing, and during a lame duck U.S. president and presidential campaign.
And it seems, as you've mentioned, Anders Aslan, that Western diplomats are asleep on vacation, and there's certainly nothing coming from the White House. But my sense is that Vladimir Putin, although he's certainly a rational person, he does seem to, of late, changed his tactics, and he's getting, I think, more bold and much more provocative. For example, with the polonium poisoning of Litvinenko, the dissident spy in London, Putin's fingerprints were clearly on it because you can't get polonium off the shelf. But on the other hand, he didn't really, there was no way to pin it on him. But he was also getting the best of both worlds. He was sending a signal to possibly dissident FSB and SVR officers that this is your fate if you talk out of school. But now it seems, with all of this stuff going on, with the Russian hacks, with the GRU and the FSB hacks, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, what they discovered in those hacks was a real deliberate signal sent saying, ha ha, we're Russian. And the theory that I'm hearing is that Putin is basically, normally when these foreign intelligence services hack the US or hack each other or hack whoever, they slip in quietly and undetected. They lurk and loiter for months, perhaps even years, extract everything they want and then quietly exit. In this case, it was done, it seems that Putin is actually sending a signal and saying this is payback because he so obsessively believes that the US is behind all of these colored revolutions. And apparently he believes that Hillary Clinton was responsible for the 2011 demonstrations against Putin in the streets of Moscow. So do you buy that theory that Putin is basically, you know, sort of openly meddling and he doesn't mind leaving his fingerprints because he's basically saying this is payback? In other words, he's acting rather boldly.
Yeah, I think all of what you said makes sense here, but this is how Putin acts. But very importantly, it is that he has not seen the West stand up to him on any occasion for many years. And I'm not only meaning the Obama administration, but also during the Bush administration. The one exception during the Bush administration, it was when President Bush sent U.S. warships to Georgia in August 2008, and then the war stopped after only for 5 days. And also there were U.S. military transport planes coming with Georgian soldiers from Afghanistan, flying them back. And the Russians asked, what equipment do you have on the plane? And the U.S. wisely refused to answer. After that, and also before that, we haven't seen that type of U.S. standing up to Russia. And you can see how President Putin, before he started bombing in Syria on the 30th of September, President Putin met with President Obama on the 27th of September at the UN in New York and asked, in effect, will you do anything if I start bombing in Syria? And President Obama said, you belong to the 19th century, I belong to the 21st century. And in effect, President Putin said, thank you, this is exactly what I would like to hear from you. It means that I can start bombing in 3 days and you will do nothing. That conversation, of course, didn't take place, but that was the information that President Putin received from that conversation. That is the kind of conversation that must not take place.
So, given that one of the things that we talked about, the Kerch ferry and the fact that the bridge hasn't been done, apparently on this Kerch ferry, and as you mentioned earlier, the Crimean economy is tanked because of corruption and because the utilities come through Ukraine and they've been cut. The Night Wolves biker gang, which is Putin's own sort of Hell's Angels, they apparently showed up on the Kerch ferry, and they also played a symbolic role in the lead up to the 2014 annexation of the peninsula when they drove through the peninsula on a wave of anti-Maidan, you know, agitprop. So again, that's another pretty strong signal, isn't it?
Indeed. I mean, we should expect all kinds of such signals now. I haven't seen of the Night Wolves recently, but it would be quite typical if they would pop up again.
So given that you feel that Putin is, you agree with me that Putin is now sort of being openly contemptuous and not shying away from signaling that he's interfering openly, because logically you would think that a former KGB officer would know that Donald Trump is tanking in the polls and it would make more sense for him to support Hillary Clinton. But the fact that he's so overtly supporting Trump would indicate to me that he's basically sending a signal to Hillary Clinton. Do you accept that?
Well, you can say that there are two different ideas here. One is that President Putin sees that he has a free ride until Hillary Clinton comes in, because she is she has a record of being much tougher on Putin than President Obama. The alternative is that he thinks that President Trump, or rather Donald Trump, the candidate, will be helped by his actions, so that it would, on the contrary, turn around the U.S. presidential campaign and help Trump coming in, and then he will have a good friend who's grateful to him. So I think that both opportunities are open, and we should not underestimate President Putin as a daring, tactical improviser.
Well, I think your point about how this would play in the elections and help Trump is well taken, because I can just imagine Trump, when Russia's rolling into Ukraine and forging a corridor through from the Donbas into Crimea, and it's all over the headlines, and all of that war fever is going on in the media, that Trump will be crowing, saying, see, I told you so, you know, Obama is a weakling, you know, he can't do a damn thing. So wouldn't Putin's actions play into Trump's narrative?
Indeed. So I think that this could be extremely useful for Trump when he's declining. And Putin is not afraid of daring games. At the same time, he's not a risk lover. He's prepared to take big risks, but not completely off the schema.
So then, given that you feel, Anders Osland, that the U.S. hasn't stood up to Putin, and then he probes when he sees weakness, what would you recommend the Obama administration do to head off this possibility, this very real possibility that within days or even a week or so, there'll be another war in between Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, first of all, I think that if it doesn't happen within the next 2 weeks, it won't happen. So it's really a short time. What the U.S. needs to do is that the U.S. president needs to make a very tough and ambiguous statement, saying, we are not going to accept any kind of additional Russian incursion into Ukraine, and saying we will then undertake appropriate measures so that the aggressor will feel that this is not worth it. And without that, specifying what.
Right, but presumably what that would mean, it would mean arming Ukraine with heavy weapons.
Yeah, and it could also mean, for example, taking much tougher economic sanctions against Russia, and in this situation it would be no problem for the U.S. to mobilize the European Union for much tougher sanctions. So the U.S. Can, in the short term here, carry a big stick and be respected.
Well, but then, just to finish up here, though, wouldn't the logic therefore prevail on Putin that if you provoke a war, the Europeans are going to go along with the Americans for even deeper sanctions? So he wouldn't want to invite that, would he? I mean, what's the cost-benefit analysis for him?
Well, his idea is that this won't happen. If President Obama stands up within a day or two and makes a sharp statement against Putin with a clear threat of severe actions, then I think that the whole situation could turn around. You see, Putin is moving deliberately. Now he made a very strong statement today. And he is then checking, is anybody answering me?
Right, I get it.
If not, it's like when he saw Obama on the 27th of September and said, okay, he's with me, he won't object to me. Then he went on and bombed 3 days later. So say that we have 3 days now. If the West doesn't come up, and the West is essentially the U.S. president, nothing else in such a context. If that doesn't happen, then Putin will go ahead.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much. It's always Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslund, who is a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy, and his latest is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Trump is guilty of inciting violence against Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Is Trump Guilty of Inciting Violence Against Clinton? Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Epps.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And, of course, you're referring to Trump's remarks yesterday at a rally in North Carolina, where he said that Hillary Clinton wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. Of course, that is a total lie, but let's leave that aside. Wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment if she gets to pick her judges. Nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know. So does that constitute inciting violence against Clinton?
Well, you know, under the rules as set up in our Constitution, we have our First Amendment is the strongest protection of free speech in the world. That would not constitute legal incitement because a person can't be punished for inciting violence unless the speech is directed to, that is intended to, and likely to cause imminent violent action. That is, basically, think in terms of someone pointing at someone who is present and saying, kill him now. That would be incitement under the American rule. Most things are not. The philosophy being as set out by Justice Louis Brandeis, when there is time for good counsel to prevail, the remedy for speech is more speech. So the theory of the First Amendment would be Trump made this, you know, extremely injudicious and seemingly dangerous comment. There is time for everybody to say, no, don't engage in violence and counsel against it, and therefore the speech should be protected.
Well, it's, of course, one of the problems that I have with it, and a lot of people have with it. I was just talking to the Southern Poverty Law Center. They know about coded speech, and this audience of right-wing extremists that Donald Trump has attracted, people like David Duke. And my sense is that while Trump is able to make these statements with plausible deniability, the real issue to my mind is how it sounds to people who might well act upon this kind of incitement.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I certainly don't suggest that the speech is not harmful. I think that what he said was terribly harmful. It was shocking to me. I am of such an age that I was 18 years old during the 1968 when the assassinations of Senator Kennedy and Dr. King took place, and I saw the effect that that has had on our national life. And it's quite frightening. It is the case that our First Amendment doctrine has evolved to the point that even much very dangerous speech is protected under the First Amendment, and we could, you know, debate whether that's a good idea or not, but at present it's pretty well established law.
And you're referring then to the New York Times versus Sullivan, where the Supreme Court wrote, debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials.
Yes, that's right. There's a basic background principle of American constitutional law that when you're talking in particular about government and politics, speech has to be given as wide a berth as possible. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, that someone can say, I am going to harm the president. It doesn't even mean that someone can say legally, someone should harm the president. But it does mean that speech that, you know, we've seen a lot of speech in this election season where people say things like, she should be sent to the firing squad, she should be hanged. All of that is protected because, at least under the theory of the First Amendment, it is better to tolerate some of this dangerous speech than to have the government stepping in to monitor what everyone says, because the power to monitor speech involves the power to entrench government from criticism. That, at least, is the theory.
It turns out that U.S. Secret Service officials have confirmed that they have spoken to the Trump campaign regarding his comments on the Second Amendment and, you know, in fact, inviting the Second Amendment people to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing judges. So, and apparently they've said, the Secret Service said there's been more than one conversation on the topic. That's all I know. Do you know anything, Garrett?
No, I know that Mr. Trump has denied that these conversations took place. You know, we don't have an on-the-record statement from the Secret Service that they took place. This is a report by unnamed sources to CNN. Frankly, between CNN and Mr. Trump, I would choose to believe CNN, but nonetheless, that's where it stands right now. It would be surprising to me if the Secret Service had not taken an interest in this and some of the other conversations that have been had out of the Trump campaign, where you've had campaign officials saying things like firing squad, noose, she should be shot. I wouldn't be surprised, because the Secret Service has the mandate to, and has absolutely the legal authority to investigate close cases to try to figure out where whether an actual threat or a conspiracy was intended. And the Supreme Court, just as the Supreme Court protects freedom of speech, the Supreme Court has also been very protective of the Secret Service and its power to investigate in close cases. There was a case in the 80s in which a gentleman who was mentally disturbed reported to the authorities. He wrote a letter saying that this mysterious figure he called Mr. Image was going to kill President Reagan, and they had to prevent him from doing that. And the Secret Service arrested him and interrogated him on the grounds that they weren't sure that he wasn't talking about himself. And the Supreme Court, even though charges were later dropped, the Supreme Court said, you know, that's a reasonable thing to do, that investigative technique, to move in, try to make sure there is no danger to the president. This is a very important function of the government. So the Secret Service, I would think, would be quite aggressive in trying to find out what's going on inside the Trump campaign that's leading to this kind of talk.
Well, specifically, though, Garrett Epps, he was talking about, first of all, he's floating this canard that she wants to get rid of the Second Amendment, which is not true. She wants to revisit Heller, which was a pretty extraordinary decision pushed through by Justice Scalia, where they essentially reversed the cart and the horse in the Second Amendment, where the citizen's right to bear arms shall not be infringed, which the predicate of which is the state shall well have a well-regulated militia. And the, I'm trying to think of this, the state shall have a well-regulated militia.
It's a well-regulated militia being necessary.
Being necessary for the freedom of a free, being necessary for the security, let's emphasize that word, security of a free state. The citizen's right to bear arms shall not be infringed. That's, so they abandoned the predicate and the context and then flipped the second part to be the dominant part of the law now. So I think all she's saying is we need to revisit Heller, because Heller essentially turned the Second Amendment on its head. Is that your understanding?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that the people who are trying to change the law, it's not the Clinton campaign. It's not the Democrats. They have indicated that they can live with Heller, which says only the following. Heller says that a law-abiding citizen has a right to possess a handgun in the home for the purposes of self-defense, full stop. It does not say you have a right to possess any sort of military-style weapons. It does not say you have the right under the Constitution to carry a firearm, either in public as open carry or a concealed firearm. And the gun rights advocates have tried to establish these principles and have failed in the lower courts. The Supreme Court has not reviewed those cases. They've been allowed to stand. So that at present, the Heller right is quite narrow. And I think that most people in the gun control community think, you know, we can get along fine with this rule. It's a very limited rule. It allows plenty of leeway for state and local governments to regulate firearms according to their local conditions. The radicals, the people who are trying to change the meaning of the Second Amendment, are the ones on the pro-gun side who now are taking the position that we have to have judges who believe the government has no power to regulate guns. They take the position quite openly that guns are means of political action. They call them the means of dissent, and that citizens need to have guns in order to threaten government officials, as was done in Oregon earlier this year. That's the radical change in the Second Amendment. It's coming from the Trump side. There is no particular agenda that I can detect from the Democratic and progressive legal community to do anything to the Second Amendment except say the Heller right is not going to be expanded to limits that the framers of the Second Amendment would simply not recognize.
Well, the NRA apparently have decided in the aftermath of this controversy over Trump's remarks to unveil a new 30-second television ad on Wednesday that accuses Hillary Clinton, without any offering any evidence, of plotting to take away people's guns. And, of course, it accuses Clinton of hypocrisy because she's now wealthy and and for much of her adult life has been protected by armed security personnel. I'm not sure what the point of that is, but I guess it's a sort of mixing the Second Amendment with kind of working class white angry grievance. Is that, how would you interpret it?
Well, the NRA are masters of the politics of resentment, and they take the position that any common sense gun regulation is the end of liberty in the United States. When they won the Heller case, when the gun rights side won the Heller case, their reaction was not to say, my gosh, we have won this landmark decision that establishes some part of the Second Amendment right that we favor. It wasn't that at all. Their reaction was to say, this is the end of the world. Our gun rights hang by one vote, because Heller was a 5-4 decision. So that, at every moment, it is essential to them. It's part of their business model that they tell the people who are their members, the people who fund them, that they're in terrible danger. They're in danger from government bureaucrats. They're in danger from government officials. They're in danger from UN soldiers who are going to come take their guns away. They're in danger from people who are different from them. You know, different racial groups are coming to kill them. This is how they keep the money flowing. The NRA, which began life as a very responsible sportsman's organization and remained that for nearly a century, has been taken over by an extraordinarily extreme, far-right group of people who are torn between basically disrupting our civic life, as Trump has done, or just raking in the money from credulous contributors.
Well, just to go back to the Second Amendment itself, which we were talking about a minute ago, Garrett Epps, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, that seems to me to be the part that's missing here, because how can you argue in America today that we are secure and free from gun violence?
Well, you know, Justice Breyer, in his dissent dissents in Heller and in McDonald versus City of Chicago, you know, made this point quite forcefully and I think eloquently, in which he said, in order to evaluate the extent of the right protected by the Second Amendment, we have to look at the concrete effects that it has in a given situation. And he points out that Washington, D.C. Has a very high murder rate, that the people of the city themselves, I mean, that the people in these crime-ridden neighborhoods, and I live on Capitol Hill and very close to areas where crime rate remains stubbornly high, these people were begging the government, get these guns off the street. The police are begging the government, get these guns off the street. They're a danger to us. They're a danger to the community. People are dying from them. A great deal of gun violence occurs in the form of suicide, you know, where people in a fit of depression shoot themselves, causing horrible damage to their family, to the people who have to clean it up. Sometimes this damage lasts for generations. And he said, we have to allow government to take account of the concrete effects of gun violence in a given situation. And it may be necessary and it may be appropriate for a city like Chicago or a city like Washington, D.C. to have stricter gun rules than, you know, some place in rural Iowa. Justice Scalia insisted that was nonsense. Nonsense. He said, we have rights and we don't limit them. They're written in the Constitution and we don't care what effect those rights have. This, of course, was extremely hypocritical. I mean, in another decision in which the court held that Guantanamo detainees had a right to petition the courts for habeas corpus, and habeas corpus being a right that is also guaranteed in the Constitution, in so many words, Justice Scalia from the bench read a bitter dissent saying, don't you realize these are bad people, and if they can bring writs of habeas corpus, they'll get loose. And he said, Americans will die. Well, that's what Breyer was saying, is your interpretation of the Second Amendment cannot be in harmony with what the Constitution requires, with what the framers wanted, because they did not decide to set up a constitution that would create a violent, dangerous society. They wanted a constitution that would permit a democratic, self-governing republic. And as the historian Jill Lepore has written quite eloquently, in a country in which guns are carried regularly on the street and in public, there is no such thing as civil society. There is no civilian life. We are all in a war zone all the time. And that is the aim of the so-called gun rights movement. And they've made tremendous strides toward putting us in to that kind of situation. And to see in the year 2016 a presidential candidate, you know, hinting, playing peekaboo, playing dog whistle with the idea that his opponent deserves to be shot, that just tells you how degraded our public life has become in significant part because of the well-funded, well-organized extremists who run the gun rights movement.
But again, Hillary Clinton, in order to appoint justices to the Supreme Court, would have had to been sworn in as President of the United States. So if you construe, and if many people do, the what Trump said as an invitation to violence or an incitement and a threat, then it is a threat against a president. Now, she's not there yet, so I don't know whether that makes it a kind of an abstraction, but that, to me, is, I mean, doesn't the Secret Service's job transcend a lot of the laws that we're talking about?
Well, the Secret Service operates within a framework of law, to be sure.
Sure, but
they have every right to investigate whether something was a threat. I've watched the video very carefully, and I don't think it was what we consider to be a threat under law. A threat mm-hmm. is a statement of intention, present intention, to inflict harm or cause harm to be inflicted on somebody. It can be conditional, right? You can say, you know, if you don't give me that, I will shoot you. That is a threat. You don't have to be able to shoot me. You don't even have to have a gun. If you say that in a way that a reasonable person would understand to mean, I am going to hurt you if you don't do what I want, you have committed the offense. It's not like an incitement. Right? It doesn't have to be likely to be carried out. So the question is, was Trump saying, you know, if Clinton becomes president, you know, Hillary Clinton, if you become president, if she becomes president, she will be shot. That's illegal. That right. is, there is a special statute.
Right. But she has to be stopped. Right.
But that says if you threaten a major party candidate, you've committed a felony. So right. the question will have to be to interpret, you know, his words to see if that's what he was saying. As I parse them, I think he was not. I think he was, you know, in common sense terms, not legal terms, but common sense terms, I think he was inciting people. I think he was suggesting to people they might want to think about regarding the Secretary Clinton as an illegitimate figure in our politics who needs to be dealt with by extra legal means. Because of the very strict rules about incitement under the Constitution, I don't think he can be punished. So the question is, was it really a threat? I think probably not, but I think the Secret Service has every right to investigate the context. They have every right to ask, why is it that people connected with your campaign seem to turn to talk of violence so often? Is this part of some kind of strategy? And you know, if I were them, I would be questioning not just Mr. Trump, but some of the people that have been around him who've been making these public statements. Well, and they are absolutely protected by the laws in doing that.
Sure. Well, just in closing, though, Garrett, just to circle back on the Heller case, it was, of course, brought about, I believe, by the city of Washington, D.C., because it had the highest street violence and gang shootings, etc., and it was a very dangerous place. And I find it highly ironic that Justice Scalia, there in the Supreme Court, is, what, less than a mile from where people were being shot down in the streets. And yet, I mean, the ruling that came about was to strike down the D.C. ordinance, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And you have to understand that the late Justice Scalia, on the subject of firearms in particular, was really not rational. He had He had been in love with guns and shooting his whole life. He was on the rifle team in high school. And he loved to kill big animals. He possessed a number of guns. He apparently persuaded Justice Kagan, who had never fired a firearm before she went on the court, to learn to shoot and go hunting with him. It was just a subject upon which he was not particularly rational. And this was his crusade. And Justice Thomas also was to change the law, to get established the principle that there is a robust right to firearms ownership under the First Amendment. I think Heller was wrongly decided. I think Heller is a bad case. But I think we have to be aware that the people trying to change the law further, the people trying to transform the Second Amendment, it's not the left, it's the right. And they believe that guns and shooting are not prominent enough in our national life yet.
Right.
We haven't had enough mass murders. We need more.
Right. We have the best armed criminals, the best armed terrorists. They can't fly on our planes, but they can own assault
Absolutely.
Rifles.
And
here they have this massive victory in Heller, and it's not enough. I get the picture.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Garrett. I appreciate your time.
Yes, enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and he's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions of the Supreme Court, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Is Trump Guilty of Inciting Violence Against Clinton? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into what Second Amendment people who wear T-shirts with snipers on rooftops mean by rooftop voting.
But it won't be long, because kids with guns, easy does it, they got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tom Diaz, who's a writer, lawyer, and public speaker on the gun industry and gun control, formerly a senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center. He is the author of Making a Killing, and his latest book is The Last Gun, How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What It Will Take to Stop It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Diaz.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what did you make of Donald Trump's coy invitation to Second Amendment people to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing Supreme Court judges based upon this the lie that she wants to abolish the Second Amendment, which you cannot abolish constitutional amendments by snapping your fingers. I mean, in the real world, that's a ridiculous claim. But anyway, he said, Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks, although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know. So that's what he said. His people have spun it and make it sound innocuous. Paul Ryan said it was a bad joke. But my sense is that it's more a question of which audience is interpreting it. And it seems to me that the people that Donald Trump has brought out of the woodwork, the white supremacists, the David Dukes of this world, they see what he's saying as a very clear and direct signal. At least that's my analysis. What's your analysis?
Well, I agree with your analysis and maybe with a little bit of refinement. The first thing I thought was this is not new in the gun rights movement thinking, and I think Donald Trump or somebody around him is aware of that. So I immediately thought back 6 years ago, there was a woman named Sharon Angle ran for the Senate against Harry Reid, and she said a number of, at the time, people thought really troublesome, and some people thought quite shocking things. For example, she said, if we don't win at the ballot box, what will be the next? And she started talking about something she called Second Amendment remedies. It's interesting that in this past, in May of this year, Donald Trump actually called out Sharon Angle, recognized her at an event, and she was trying to get the Republican nomination again and was didn't succeed in getting it. But my point is that this is a strain of thought that has a not necessarily long, but a sort of medium-long history in right-wing gun right thinking, and if anything, it's just gotten worse. You talked about reality. Donald Trump is appealing to people who have a completely different sense of reality. I'll give you some specific examples. If you look at the National Rifle Association's monthly magazine, they call America's Freedom, America's First Freedom. It's their political magazine. And the current issue has the phrase, the inescapable epidemic, the inescapable epidemic of lies. And there's a teaser on the front that says, everywhere you turn, Washington leaders lie, the media mislead us, and billionaires belittle our beliefs. What this conveys to that audience, which includes the extremists, is that everything about Washington, everything about the federal government is illegitimate. Now, if you think about that, that's really concerning. There are sort of three anchors to their thought. One is the politicians, of course, they're dismissed as liars, corrupt, and people who have secret plans. One of them being, according to this train of thought, Hillary wants to abolish the Second Amendment, which, of course, is ridiculous. She's never said that. She said many times that she actually respects the Second Amendment. And even Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, who wrote one of the most pro-gun opinions in Supreme Court history, said there are limits to the Second Amendment right. So this whole thought that politicians are lying is part of the triangle. The other one is, of course, is that the media are lying. You can't believe anything the media tell you. There's a secret truth that the media know, but they're either distorting or holding from you. And the final, the base of this triangle of thought, we attack politicians, we attack the media, and this is the most troublesome to me, is the attack on the very process of democracy. We start seeing that now, the way Trump signals, well, the election is rigged. If it's true, and put yourself in the frame of mind of these people, if it's true that politicians are corrupt, have secret plans, you can't believe anything you read in the media, and even the processes of democracy, which is what this country theoretically is all about, even they are corrupt, then, as Sharon Angle said, what is the next step? What do you do? The answer in this community that we're talking about is you turn to your guns. The final point I'll make is what then becomes most frightening is the gun industry has so changed what I call the topography of gun ownership in America to a militarized gun ownership that they literally are now across this country, and we've seen some terrible examples of it, of military-style weaponry. So that if the David Dukes of the world, the unknown people lurking in basements of the world, the people who respond to the kind of dog whistle that Donald Trump has just blown, if they decide to take arms, it's a small matter. It could be potentially very serious. So, like everybody else, I know Donald Trump's modus operandi, which is that he will say, somehow try to explain it, but he said the words that have a history and that resonate with people who listen to those words.
So let's zero in on those words, the Sharon Angle words. that you mentioned, what do they mean by Second Amendment remedies? Because essentially that's what Trump was saying, that the Second Amendment people are going to stop Hillary.
If you take the reference to that she also quoted, it's good for a society to have a revolution every 20 years. What this all really means is basically armed revolt. It means going to the guns and overturning the result of the ballot box. Now, there is actually a sort of meme that's very popular in this community, and you can see it in T-shirts, you can see it on websites, and it says, vote from the rooftops, or if all else fails, vote from the rooftops, or voting from the rooftops. It's often accompanied by a print of a person with a sniper rifle. So voting from the rooftops essentially means you go to the rooftop with your sniper rifle and you change the results of the election. That is stark and harshing, but that's harsh, but that's what it ultimately means.
And this voting from the rooftops is a well-understood meme within this community of Second Amendment people?
Yes, yes, it is. There are two phrases that I think one sees moving toward the more radical part of the spectrum. The other one is this Greek phrase, molon labe, which means come and get them. And supposedly it was a message transmitted at, I think, the Battle of Marathon, which meant we're not going to surrender. If you want our weapons, you come get them. So you'll see these often at rallies and at gatherings of the more, what should I say, militant members of the gun rights community. And it's basically, there is no legitimate political result than the one we endorse. And if we feel that we are threatened or that we've lost, then we can go to the rooftops. And if you want to try to take our guns, fine, come and get them. I also want to make reference to another phrase that's sort of well known, that the executive director of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre, said at a nationally televised event some years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago, and he said, quote, the guys with the guns make the rules. The guys with the guns make the rules. Now, what does that mean? It means that, no, the democratic processes mean nothing unless you have guns to affect the result that you want. So you take all of this kind of thought together, I think it's clear that the call is for armed resistance to a result that one concludes is intolerable. Now, where that line is might vary for people. I don't know.
Well, Tom Dears, I thank you for joining us. This is a very alarming conversation, albeit, I think, a realistic one and a well-founded one.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Dears, who's a writer, lawyer, and public speaker on the gun industry and gun control, formerly a senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center. He is the author of Making a Killing, and his latest book is The Last Gun, How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What It Will Take to Stop It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.